This is a preview of episode 10.2, The Madness of Gene Wolfe's Shadow and Claw. To get access to the full thing via Substack or Patreon, head on over to madmethodpod.com/subscribe for the links. You'll get access to not only this episode and the other Madness episodes, but you'll also get early access to pretty much everything I drop on this channel and the occasional special presentation. Thanks and enjoy.
What is a book in itself? A book is a physical object in a world of physical objects. It is a set of dead symbols. And then the reader, the right reader, comes along and the words, or rather the poetry behind the words, for the words themselves are mere symbols, spring into life, and we have a resurrection of the world.
I can't read these first two volumes of Gene Wolfe's Book of the New Sun tetralogy without thinking of Borges. That's Jorge Luis Borges. For people who aren't familiar, Borges was an Argentine poet, critic, and author of some of the most influential fiction of the last 100 years. Some of his most enduring short stories, and he never wrote a piece of fiction longer than 14 pages, include stories such as Tlan, Ukbar, Orbius Tertius, about a country that starts out as a fictional project slash experiment and over time infiltrates our own reality. Another well-known story of his is The Garden of Forking Paths, which is difficult to convincingly summarize but deals in the interplay between texts within the text, possible futures, and labyrinths of time. There's also the Borges story Funes the Memorius, which is a sort of existential horror story about the traumatic reality that would ensue if one really had the perfect memory that Severian claims. The first part of Book of the New Sun that will trip the Borges censors for an attentive reader comes in Chapter 6 of Shadow of the Torturer. It's here that Severian is sent to the Master Oltan at the library. Of course, a library is not a unique setting for a book, a fantasy book or a science fiction book, but Borges wrote perhaps the most well-known piece of fiction about a library, and this, of course, is the Library of Babel. In this story, Borges imagines a library which contains every conceivable book of 410 pages, that is, every possible combination of letters and spaces that could fill a 410-page book. A book with nothing but the letter A printed throughout. One with nothing but the letter Z, and every statistical iteration in between. Wolfe does not just replay this same conceit, though there do seem to be nearly enough books in this library to distort one's perceptions of space-time. Instead of imagining all the possible contents that a book could possibly have, Wolfe thinks through some of the many, many forms a book could possibly take. Quote, "We have books here bound in the hides of echidnas, krakens, and beasts so long extinct that those whose studies they are for the most part of the opinion that no trace of them survives unfossilized. We have books bound wholly in metals of unknown alloy, and books whose bindings are covered with thick-set gems. We have books cased in perfumed woods shipped across the inconceivable gulf between creations, books doubly precious because no one on earth can read them. We have books whose papers are matted of plants from which spring curious alkaloids, so that the reader, in turning their pages, is taken unaware by bizarre fantasies and chimeric dreams. Books whose pages are not paper at all, but delicate wafers of white jade, ivory, and shell. Books, too, whose leaves are the desiccated leaves of unknown plants. Books we have also that are not books at all to the eye, scrolls and tablets and recordings on 100 different substances. There's a cube of crystal here, though I can no longer tell you where, no larger than the ball of your thumb that contains more books than the library itself does. Though a harlot might dangle it from one ear for an ornament, there are not volumes enough in the world to counterweight the other." End quote. It's worth noting here, too, that Master Oltan, an aged man who has been working in the library since boyhood, is blind. In 1938, Borges took a job as a first assistant, one might say apprentice, in a library in a working-class neighborhood in Buenos Aires. In 1955, he became the director of the Argentine National Library, and just a few years later, he would be completely blind. A quote from Master Oltan, quote, "For 7 years, I busied myself with that, and then, just when the pressing and superficial problems of preservation were disposed of, and we were on the point of beginning the first general survey of the library since its foundation, my eyes began to gutter in their sockets." He who had given all books into my keeping made me blind, so that I should know in whose keeping the keepers stand. End quote. And then here's a quote from Borges. Quote, no one should read self-pity or reproach into this statement of the majesty of God, who with such splendid irony at one touch granted me books and night. End quote. I also see an echo here with a lesser-known short story of Borges, one entitled The Book of Sand. In this story, our Borges, who is always the narrator unless we're told otherwise, is visited by a man who purports to be a Bible salesman. When Borges tells the man that he already has a number of Bibles in different versions, the salesman offers to show him another book that he picked up in India. Quote, I opened it at random. The characters were unfamiliar to me. The pages, which seemed worn and badly set, were printed in double columns, like a Bible. The text was cramped and composed of versicles. At the upper corner of each page were Arabic numerals. I was struck by an odd fact. The even number pages would carry the number 40,514, let's say, while the odd number page that followed it would be 999. The next page bore an 8-digit number. It also bore a small illustration, like those one sees in dictionaries, an anchor drawn in pen and ink, as though by the unskilled hand of a child. It was at that point that the stranger spoke again. Look at it well. You will never see it again. End quote. Sure enough, Borges can never again find that page, can never again see any one page a second time. Further, he can never quite flip his way to the first page or the last. Now, I won't spoil this story for you because it's one of my favorites, but there is certainly in Borges and in Wolf a figurative reimagining of the physical book within the work that, in my opinion, is emblematic of the literary projects that these men executed. Something that, among other things, is a kind of postmodern repositioning of classic narrative within the collective psyche. And I don't say postmodern lightly. Here's from none other than David Foster Wallace. Quote, the truth, briefly stated, is that Borges is arguably the great bridge between modernism and postmodernism in world literature. He is modernist in that his fiction shows a first-rate human mind stripped of all foundations in religious or ideological certainty, a mind turned thus wholly in on itself. His stories are inbent and hermetic, with the oblique terror of a game whose rules are unknown and its stakes everything. End quote. I'm of the opinion that Wolf was, let's call it, playing a similar game to Borges, though Wolf is doing it between the postmodern and what we've come to call genre. He was perhaps not the first to play this game, but surely one of the very best. Now, so far, I'm not uncovering anything about the work of Gene Wolfe that hasn't been repeated in a dozen other places. In his book of essays on writing the Book of the New Sun, entitled Castle of the Otter, Wolfe states that he drew on Borges' Book of Imaginary Creatures for the character of Baldanders. He also cites Borges' so-called bird argument from the book Dream Tigers as a unique thought experiment on the nature and existence of God. But where the overlap between the work of Borges and Wolfe gets most interesting, for me, is on the subject of mirrors. Now, as you'll recall from the Book of the New Sun, a kind of possibly magic technology is used for faster-than-light travel or teleportation. Severian and others refer to this technology as a mirror. In one of my favorite passages from Shadow of the Torturer, we get an anecdotal recounting of an encounter with Father Neri, which is the book's first real stab at exposition around the mirrors and their capabilities. Quote, in the center of the enclosure, just under the lamp, was a haze of yellow light. It was never still, she said. It moved up and down and from side to side with rapid flickerings, never leaving a space that might have been four spans high and four long. It did indeed remind her of a fish, much more than the faint flagi she had glimpsed in the mirrors of the Hall of Meaning ever had, a fish swimming in air, confined to an invisible bowl. Father Neri drew the wall of the octagon closed behind him. It was a mirror in which she could see his face and hand and shining, indefinite robes reflected. Her own form, too, and the fish's. But there seemed to be another girl, her own face peering down over her shoulder, then another, and another, and another, each with a smaller face behind it, and so on ad infinitum, an endless chain of fainter domina faces. She realized when she saw them that the wall of the octagonal enclosure through which she had passed faced another mirror. In fact, all the others were mirrors. The light of the blue-white lamp was caught by them all and reflected from one to another as boys might pass silver balls, interlacing and intertwining in an interminable dance. In the center, the fish flickered to and fro, a thing formed, as it seemed, by the convergence of the light. Here you see him, Father Inyuri said. The ancients who knew this process at least as well as we, and perhaps better, considered the fish the least important and most common of the inhabitants of Specula. With their false belief that the creatures they summoned were ever present in the depths of the glass, we need not concern ourselves. In time, they turned to a more serious question. By what means may travel be affected when the point of departure is at an astronomical distance from the place of arrival? Now, here's a little bit later. Domina and Father Neri have some conversations about candlelight vis-a-vis the mirrors. Quote, such a candle could be made, but its light would fly no more swiftly. Yet, even though light is so weightless we have given its name to that condition, it presses against what it falls on, just as wind, which we cannot see, pushes the arms of a mill. See now what happens when we provide light to mirrors set face to face. The image they reflect travels from one to the other and returns. Suppose it meets itself in returning. What do you suppose happens then? Domina laughed, despite her fear, and said she could not guess. Father Inyuri carried on. Why, it cancels itself. Think of two little girls running across a lawn without looking where they're going. When they meet, there are no more little girls running. But if the mirrors are well made and the distances between them are correct, the images do not meet. Instead, one comes behind the other. That has no effect when the light comes from a candle or a common star, because both the earlier light and the later light that would otherwise tend to drive it forward are only random white light, like the random waves a little girl might make by flinging a handful of pebbles into a lily pond. But if the light is from a coherent source and forms the image reflected from an optically exact mirror, the orientation of the wave fronts is the same because the image is the same. Since nothing can exceed the speed of light in our universe, the accelerated light leaves it and enters another. When it slows again, it re-enters ours, naturally, at another place. Is it just a reflection? Domina asked. She was looking at the fish. Eventually, it will be a real being, if we do not darken the lamp or shift the mirrors. For a reflected image to exist without an object to originate it violates the laws of our universe, and therefore an object will be brought into existence. End quote. Now, Borges, all his life, was terrified of mirrors and reflective surfaces. Here's from a poem of his, quote, as a boy, I used to fear that the mirror might reveal to me another face, or a blind, impersonal mask, doubtless hiding some atrocious being, end quote. He had the sense that if the thing in the mirror was real, it might somehow usurp him. He also feared that sometimes when he looked into the mirror, he saw another face, which is the crux of one of his most unsettling short stories, entitled Covered Mirrors. There's also a line in Tlon that goes, quote, mirrors and copulation are abominable because they multiply mankind, end quote. And to me, most significantly in this line, Borges once wrote, quote, there is a concept which corrupts and upsets all others. I refer not to evil, whose limited realm is that of ethics. I refer to the infinite.
In these temples. And then the central hall has a group of mirror works, which are concave, and in a way, of course, turn the world upside down, or illusory objects between painting and sculpture. Between, it's as if you can't tell what the object is. That's what I'm after. My real purpose is this question about the status of the object itself and its relation to the viewer.
This is like more real. This is looking at a parallel world that I'm standing here because it's so crystal clear. It's almost there is another myself in a different world. It's interesting because I was just wondering in the main hall, looking at those mirrors.
Yes.
And it's because if you consider this place, yes. This is the ancestral
yes.
temple. This is where, in ancient times, the
yes.
emperors
yes.
would talk to their ancestors in a way, the communication hall. And looking at those mirrors, it seems it's unreal. I said to the camera, because you are kind of talking to yourself on the other side. But in a twisted way.
Yes.
And sometimes you can't see yourself.
Exactly. So you're talking to yourself upside down in a way.
Upside down too.
Upside down, yeah. So it's, and I think that's my real purpose. You know, I mean, to put it very, very simply, We think of ourselves, this is me.
The body, physical
the body. The body, physically. But actually, if I close my eyes, this is not me. I'm much other, I'm much bigger, I have other space inside me. Mm. We all know this in different ways. And the question is whether the object itself can kind of induce that sense of another time, another place, before or after. That's the conversation you were just talking about. This thing about the ancestors. It's a kind of memory. It's a kind of absent but present thing. It's not gone. It's not there. It's actually physically there. So we engage in this as human beings. That's what being human is about, isn't it, at one level.
That was from an interview with the artist Anish Kapoor and a documentary about his first exhibit in China. This frisson that Bohr has felt about mirrors, their implications, their metaphor, and, you know, in a way, the fact that a mirror is an instantiation of a metaphor, right? One way to poetically interpret a mirror is that it is, in fact, a material kind of metaphor, a metaphor for a metaphor, and is not a metaphor a kind of mirror. Anyway, this thing Bohr has felt, all of it, is to my mind distilled and amplified in the concept of teleportation, as utilized in the Book of the New Sun and in science fiction more generally. Sure, we get the gee whiz solution to the ancient problem of moving from point A to point B, but the trade-off is the existential quandary of whether an exact copy of ourselves suddenly appearing somewhere else is in fact us, or if something is not lost along the way. Or is this just a funhouse mirror throwing back the image of rationally plausible resurrection? Is teleportation death and resurrection? Well, we're going to get there, but first I want to talk about the opposite of mirrors. I want to talk about the color black.